Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
There was a UFC fighter, Evan Tanner. And so Evan Tanner was like he was a UFC champion at some point. And I remember James really, like, he was kind of obsessed with the story. At some point, Evan Tanner, not long after his height, you know, of his career, he, like, jumped on a motorcycle and went out into the desert just to, like, rough it for a while, just to go completely off the grid. And at some point, like, he never came back. And so people went looking for him, and they finally found him, and his motorcycle had broken down, and he was where he could not have gotten back. And so this is the kind of story that occurs to me that James had in his brain for a long time and would, like, routinely work in, like, some kind of Evan Tanner joke here or there. And if somebody told me that James had done that, that James was just going to go off grid, that's not a stretch for me to believe at all.
At the beginning of this year, James Foster Chance disappeared from Grapevine, Texas, sometime in the 60 days between the end of January and the end of March. During that time, Texas experienced a record-setting winter storm, leaving most of the state without power for days. This seems to be a crucial point in James's disappearance, though we don't know the exact day he disappeared, or even the exact month. His disappearance has some strange aspects and lots of unanswered questions. But one thing that we do know is that he hasn't been seen in the last 8 months. This is a story that will leave you questioning how much you can really ever know someone. Do people only show you the side of themselves that they want you to see? And what could even your closest loved ones be hiding from you? I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 318 of The Vanished. James Foster Chance's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices and audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. James Foster Chance was a Marine Corps veteran and a talented networking specialist who worked with telecommunications companies. He had worked in Little Rock, Arkansas for several years before his company relocated him to the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. We spoke to James's Aunt Terry for this episode, as she saw James most often since she lives in that area. Some of James's family members call him by his middle name, Foster, so you may hear her call him that also. We asked Terry to start at the beginning and tell us who James, or Foster as she calls him, is.
As a child, I didn't get the opportunity. Connie and Ken always lived away. They lived in Atlantic. His job transferred him. And they never really lived close to us, so probably saw him growing up a couple of times a year at the most. And I would say that Foster was your typical youngest child. He was happy. He was funny. His big brother was a little jealous of him. Just typical stuff. He was a fun little kid. Always smart, always inquisitive. You know, I think he was always a little different. I don't think he was ever big into sports. He sewed. His mother was a big sewer. And I know that sounds a little strange, but he really enjoyed doing that. And he would make his own patterns and make his own clothes. Video games and gaming, I'm pretty confident in saying his dad, Ken, enjoyed doing that and grew up doing that together. Foster and his brother and Ken. They worked on cars. As far as being real involved in school activities or sports activities, I don't really think he was.
We also talked to James's parents, Connie and Ken. We asked them to give us a better picture of who James is as a person.
He's a good kid, the youngest of three. We have an older son and a daughter. Growing up was pretty much normal. They had a bit of moving around because we were in the service to begin with, settled down in Colorado Springs. We were there for 10 years. He attended elementary and junior high. We moved to Phoenix, and he was in high school down here, and that was when he started driving and everything. He's a good kid. He's excellent student, great grades, shy. I mean, pretty outgoing once you got to know him, but he's shy, you know, initially. And he's real big-hearted. I mean, he would do anything. As soon as he was convinced that you needed help, he'd do it for you.
After graduating from high school, Terry told us that James went straight into the military.
He joined the Marines immediately after high school. I mean, probably within a month. He joined the Marines. I think he went to California for basic training. They pulled him out. Somebody spotted him. They pulled him out, and they put him on the silent drill team, which is a big, huge deal if you don't know anything about it. And that's what he did for the next maybe 4 years. So from the time he was 18 to maybe 22, he served on the line for, I think, 2 years in the drill team. And then he was actually the drill master or sergeant or whatever. You know, they have one person that, you know, is the leader. I don't know what the ranking was of it. But for a couple of years, Foster did that. And it was the second year he did it, it was kind of a really unheard of thing. I don't think they usually let people do that 2 years in a row. You know, he lived at 8th and I for the most part, traveled all over the country, did presentations in front of foreign dignitaries and presidents and accompanied the president. It was a big deal.
After his military career, James relocated to where his parents lived in Phoenix, Arizona. And that's when he got involved in the telecom industry. This is what his mom, Connie, told us about that period of his life.
He stayed in the East for a while and went to school and worked. Then he moved back to Phoenix, was here for a couple of years, got married, got divorced. That was all pretty quick. And he was married for like 2 years, maybe going on three. Oh, they had a good time. She's a really smart lady and fast enough on her feet to keep up with him. He doesn't have a lot of patience with people that he kind of perceives as slow or not being able to keep up with it. Repartee, which he enjoys, and he wants it fast and snappy. I mean, they were a good match. She had a troubled past, and she was out here and from back east somewhere, Pennsylvania, I think, around Hershey. And they lived here. We had great family lives, you know, family Christmases. Everything was wonderful. His brother had small children at the time, and they all got on famously. He did a very brief stint with his brother in a construction support, residential construction support kind of thing. They did a hauling thing. That just did not work out. But the two boys tried really hard, but they just didn't see eye to eye on things, and that eventually was just dissolved. Anyway, he went back to Altel, and from there on, it was the computers and telecommunication. I think he and Jennifer just ended up not being able to help one another. Foster seemed a bit depressed that his relationship was going south, and he kind of pulled away from the family so as not to expose his personal problems to the rest of us for whatever reason. And they sold their house. She left town I never saw her again after that, which is too bad because I miss her to this day. She's a great lady. And then he moved to Arkansas. He was working for, I think it was Altel at the time, here in Phoenix, and he transferred to Little Rock, Arkansas, and he just fit in really well there. There were some, I guess, gregarious fellows in his outfit there, and he got to be a little more outgoing, and he was doing things and having experiences he hadn't had growing up, like stock car races and southern fishing and things like that. He was not in contact with family much during that period. He had a cousin living up there, you know, like one township or whatever over. But they did not socialize. He had a childhood, I mean, like across the street neighbor friend who was stationed at the Air Force base there, and they had no contact. He was just kind of a loner, other than when, I guess, once he got to know him, because there were fishing trips, there's directions to a cabin somewhere or another, notes about buying a particular type of fishing rod, which are things he never did here. He was really gassed about the stock car races, because that was never anything we exposed him to as a kid.
Not long after his divorce, James took a job in Little Rock, Arkansas, where he was able to have a bit of a fresh start.
And when he went to Little Rock, he didn't bother telling us. We kind of had to chase him down that time, but we did. And, you know, it's been great since then. I'm back and forth with the visits. He didn't give us a reason for having just left Phoenix, other than, like I say, I don't think he wanted anybody to know what was going on in his life. I think the divorce was a fail on his part, you know. He felt like it was a fail on his part, and he didn't want to have to explain himself to anybody, which, right or wrong, I guess he didn't. Their problems were pretty evident, and there wasn't much explanation necessary. The two of them agreed they were not going to be in contact. And to my knowledge, they never were again. Then he was in Little Rock and had a really good time out there. He bought a house, set up his own housekeeping thing, and started decorating the house, and all this stuff was active. The other guys in his office unit, he was in Little Rock for a couple of years and transferred to the Dallas area. He worked out of the South Lake office. That was in 2009. That was Verizon. It was for the network repair unit. He did the call-in tech work for the public sector, like cops and hospitals and emergencies and things like that. It wasn't just your everyday, hey, my phone's not working, what do I need to do? And you do a hard reset sort of thing. He worked with agencies that had to have their communications, you know, functional at all times. Smart kid, real smart guy. And while he was in Dallas, where my family is from, that area, he spent a fair amount of time socializing with my younger sister and her children, who are about, I don't know, 12 to 15 years younger than he is. They did lots of stuff. They, you know, went to concerts, went to shows, did out-of-town things, going to the casinos for a show, you know, that somebody just wanted to see or whatever. Anyway, he was real involved with them. He would go out and spend weekends at my sister's house, which was out in Lindale, Texas.
We were also able to speak with one of James's friends and former coworkers, Doug, and he gave us a different perspective on who James was.
From the time I met James, I mean, just immediately, the first thing that impresses you with him is he's very intense. I mean, and I've got friends that are, you know, Marine Corps in their past, and they're similarly intense. James had maybe a little bit more on just his intensity. He, you know, walked with an extreme upright posture. He had kind of a low bearing in his brow when he would look at you or when he was listening to you, especially if he was listening to something pretty intensely. He, you know, was a big guy. And so he had kind of a physical prowess about him as well. You know, he talked very deliberately, but was just an extremely intelligent guy. And so his sense of humor was really kind of where you picked up on how smart he was, just at kind of the quick, you know, bounce back comments and things like that he could make. And then, you know, I got the luxury of working around him too. So you could really, really see him work through complexities there. So James and I were actually assigned to the same networking team at a telecommunications provider called Altel Wireless back around 2005. And he and I, we both were, you know, reasonably similarly inclined in the things we were interested in. And we spent obviously a lot of time together troubleshooting pretty complex stuff at work. And James always had a really, you know, kind of dry, a little bit cynical sense of humor. And he and I shared that in common. So I think we caught a lot of the same laughs together and pretty immediately hit it off. He was just an extremely, extremely intelligent man. He just immediately impressed you with his ability to kind of decode complicated issues. He was certainly more technical than I was. So he always kind of lent a hand to me and mentoring me on problems that were more complicated than I was equipped to answer.
Doug told us that after many years of close friendship, Doug and his wife moved to Northwest Arkansas, and James left Arkansas entirely for Dallas. So they didn't see each other as frequently, and life took them in separate directions.
I think James is a couple of years older than I am. James actually dated my wife. He actually dated her best friend for a pretty long period of time. I want to say more than a year. So James and I, we were really kind of woven together for a while. He was even in my wedding, back in 2009. So we had a really, really close relationship, spent a lot of time together. But I moved to Jonesboro in 2011, and James would come up here sometimes, and honestly, it was about the time that we started having kids, and, kind of all your focus goes into that, and you don't have a lot of spare time. And so James and I had just kind of drifted apart during those years, and then, it was further distanced by, his relocation down to Dallas, which they did with most of the technical resources at the time, that were in Little Rock, got ported down to Dallas, and when Verizon bought out Alltel. So, we were separated by like 7 hours between us instead of just two. And so it got harder and harder to see one another. And, then communications kind of got further and further apart. To be honest, it had been a few years since I've talked to him. And not that I didn't still feel close to him or still consider him a really good friend. It just, was kind of one of those relationships that had kind of aged a little bit.
By early 2021, James was 48 years old and living alone in an apartment in Grapevine, Texas. He owned two vehicles that he kept parked at his apartment, a Dodge pickup truck and a Toyota Spyder. His family was under the impression that he was still working for Verizon. We'll have more on that later. James's disappearance wasn't reported to the police for somewhere between 30 and 90 days. We don't know exactly how long, and we'll explain that as we go through the timeline. No one knew that anything was amiss or that there may be trouble until early April, when Ken got a call from James's landlord that shocked him.
We got a call from the landlord. It was on April 12th. I was listed as a contact or something on his lease. The rent was late, and she said it had never been late. He'd been there for like 8 or 9, 10 years, and he never paid his rent late. And they had gone over there and knocked on the door, and nobody was there, and they posted things, and they couldn't get hold of him, so they called us. He had actually paid in late January. He paid 2 months' rent. He paid February, and he paid March. And so it was April before we discovered anything was wrong. He had, I think Connie mentioned, he'd kind of hunkered down. He kept saying it was because of COVID, and he told everybody this, that he just wasn't going out. He wasn't seeing anybody. He hadn't seen the relatives at Christmas, the cousins and whoever, and he hadn't been particularly communicative, although, like I say, he didn't call very often. We'd call when you'd talk to him. He'd talk your leg off, but he didn't call very often, and hadn't bothered him. But at any rate, we discovered that he hadn't paid his rent, and we finally ended up calling because they said they'd been in the apartment, and there was like, there was a couple of fans on, and there was a light on, we reported it to the Grapevine Police Department, who sent an officer over there to do a welfare check. He went in the apartment, with the landlord and reported that, indeed there was a couple of fans on and whatnot, but that there was no sign of, foul play or anything untoward. It looks just like somebody had left. So that was the beginning of this.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. James's family didn't know what to think when they got that call from his landlord. They began trying to trace James's movements. January 19th, 2021 was James's 48th birthday. He received happy birthday text messages that he responded to, so his family believes he was alive and well. Then, nearly a month later, in mid-February, it appears that James made a trip. According to Connie, James drove from Grapevine, Texas, about 30 miles north to Denton, Texas, and checked into a hotel. That's not odd, except that the days he was supposedly there were the days that the Texas storm was coming out of its worst, with many roads undrivable and many highways closed after the February 11th 133-car pileup on a major freeway, not far from where James lived, that killed six people and injured dozens. That accident occurred before the worst of the winter weather hit the state, so officials had time to treat and close the dangerously icy roads. By February 17th, the worst of the storm was gone, but damage left millions without electricity. Many roads were still closed or unsafe, and the entire region was in a very cold standstill. But it's on this date, according to Connie, that James drove his very small sports car, a Toyota MR2 Spyder, 30 miles from Grapevine to Denton to a hotel for reasons unknown.
He made a trip to Denton, Texas in the middle of February. We have that on his bank records only, and we have contacted that. He stayed at a Motel 6, and we have contacted them, and they were going to check their video to see. We would like confirmation that it was him. The dates that he stayed were 17, 18, 19 February. And that the motel confirmed that. Ken called them, and they confirmed that he was registered there for those days. The bills went through on, I think it was 19, 20, and 21 or something like that, because it was per night.
James's father, Ken, told us that he tried to confirm further via surveillance video that it was, in fact, James at the hotel and not someone using his credit card and ID. But they were unable to get any video footage.
I actually talked to the manager at the Motel 6. He was going to check their video, and I've never heard from him. It was quite late. He said, I don't think we have anything. He did confirm that he checked in, or as my wife pointed out, someone with his name and driver's license and address checked in for those 3 days. Nobody seems to have known anything about him having friends in Denton.
This trip to the Motel 6 is a major question mark in the timeline of events. As Ken said, James didn't have any known friends in that area. Was he simply looking to get away? Perhaps meeting someone? No one has found the key to unlock this part of the mystery. James was known to keep his two vehicles parked at his apartment. When they discovered that he was missing in April, one of the vehicles was also gone. Connie explained how they were able to find a date when the car was still known to be at the apartment.
We were emergency contacts and the power of attorney and everything. The apartment complex called us in order to locate him because his rent was overdue. And in 10 years, that's never happened before. So she was concerned. But they did a wellness check for me on the 12th. That was when the apartment complex called me. There was no one home. No one answered the door. She opened the door and left the notice inside the door and then went back and called us to see if we had another contact on the 12th. The 13th, I contacted the police the second time, talked to a second officer, and the report was filed on the 15th for the missing persons and was assigned to a detective at that time. The first officer that went out there said nothing was amiss. The apartment was orderly and, you know, no sign of any trauma or anything. So he was pretty much willing to let that go. The second officer that was involved read me his report the next day, and we found out from the second patrol officer, I guess the first name was off anyway, that they had contacted the tow company for the apartment complex, and they had apparently February 7th, they still had, they had checked the lot, you know, for abandons or whatever, on just a routine drive-through, and confirmed both vehicles were there. My sister and her partner went to the apartment on the 23rd of April to see if there was anything they could find out.
So we know that on February 7th, 2021, prior to the winter storm, both of James's vehicles, the sports car and his truck, were parked in their usual spots at his apartment complex. That would be a good starting point to say February 7th was prior to his disappearance. However, Namus lists James's date of disappearance as January 19th, 2021, with no public details given about why that date is the date listed. However, we noted that James's birthday is January 19th, so possibly he saw or spoke with someone on this day. We know that he had exchanged some happy birthday text messages on the 19th. We tried to ask the Grapevine Police Department about this, but were told only the detective assigned to the case could speak about it, and were unable to connect with her before this episode was produced. After the February 7th sweep of vehicles by the towing company, the only sign of James is through the financial transactions at the hotel in Denton. There was an article published by a local CBS affiliate stating that James was last seen by a neighbor cleaning up some water damage after the storm. We aren't sure who this neighbor is, and we aren't able to confirm that this information is true. The next point in the timeline that we were able to establish was February 28, 2021, when James's vehicle was captured by a license plate reader headed eastbound toward Arkansas. Ken told us what he knows about this time.
We found from bank records that he had spent a couple of nights at a Motel 6 in Denton. I think we finally decided it was the 17th, 18th, and 19th of February. It was during all the cold weather. The detective speculated that they might not have had power, although we checked with the landlord, and they had power during that time. There was some indication there might have been some water damage in his apartment. There was a couple of box fans running, and there was some cardboard taped around the fans, like they were trying to dry out the carpet or something. The doors were open under the sink, which somebody pointed out was, you know, things people do to, you know, keep their pipes from freezing. There was something from the police, and one of the neighbors said the last time they saw him, he was kind of cleaning up water damage, although his apartment doesn't seem to have any water damage. But yeah, he spent those nights, and we have he charged some gas and he went to the liquor store, and that was kind of it. Those were some of the last charges before his disappearance. As far as we know, he disappeared on the 28th. The police have him on some kind of a freeway camera in east of Dallas, Rockwall, Highway 30, yeah, and at Rockwall. And then the car was discovered at the rest stop in Texarkana.
James's parents wouldn't know for nearly two more months that the car had been left at the Welcome Center on the Arkansas side of Texarkana. But when they did find out, The news came from the detective assigned to James's case after he was reported missing in April.
We got a call from the detective saying that they had located his car at the Welcome Center outside of Texarkana. And it was actually towed on March 22nd, I believe it is. But it had been there, according to the manager of the property there, who actually works for the Department of Transportation. He said when they have cars abandoned, they'll leave them for several weeks because they figure somebody might have broken down and they're going to come get it. But it had been there for, he estimated, about 3 weeks, which would put it in the right time frame. And it was towed. Ironically, they sent him a letter. But until his name made the missing persons list, it didn't trigger anything. So it was towards the end of April before anybody contacted us about it. It was being held at this tow yard, and they're charging $50 a day. So I arranged again with the power of attorney. We arranged to get it out of the tow yard. The trooper, Arkansas State Trooper, had looked at it and said, you know, there wasn't anything untoward about it. In fact, it looked really clean, which it was. We couldn't find anything in the car itself. It has a little trunk. It has a little storage compartment. But in the glove compartment, there was this phone. And there was also, he used to carry around these little notebooks. They were like 2x3. They'd fit in your back pocket or your shirt pocket. And he'd make notes. If somebody'd say, you know, I saw a good movie the other day, he'd make a little note, or he'd make grocery lists and so forth. And there was one of those in there, although there did not seem to be any recent entries. They're grocery lists, you can't tell, but some of the other stuff looked like it was even related to, looked like the started in 2015 and was never stopped. Now, in his apartment, we found several more that, you know, each occupied about a year or so. Why he would save those, I don't know. But anyway, other than that, the car was pretty clean, although he kept his cars fairly clean. The pickup was at the apartment, and it was fairly clean. It was darn near out of gas, but it was pretty clean inside. It was very dusty outside.
Aside from the notebooks, which seemed more random than anything else, there was one other thing found in James's vehicle, and it led to a big clue that February 28th, 2021 is most likely the actual date of James's disappearance. Here's Ken again.
We got it out and got it to a dealership to have it rekeyed, and because there wasn't any keys in it. But they didn't look at it very carefully, because we did eventually, once we got it, we found that phone. We found a phone in the car when we picked it up, and I turned it over to the detective, and they have some kind of equipment that downloads stuff. And she said it had been factory reset at 3 p.m. on February 28th. They were going to try to get see if there was any other information they could get off of it. But I haven't heard from her. She was trying to get a subpoena for the cell phone records, but according to her, the district attorney turned her down on that. And so we're kind of trying to use our power of attorney to see if we could get any more cell phone records.
James's mom, Connie, told us that while the family was waiting on law enforcement to complete a search of the area around the Welcome Center with dogs, shortly after they found the abandoned car, she was surprised to find the phone inside the vehicle.
When the cadaver dog search was scheduled, we went up to the Welcome Center because we wanted to be on hand should anything come amiss there. And we also picked up the car from the dealership. It had been at the tow yard, and Kim had it taken to the dealership so it could be checked out mechanically and rekeyed. So we were there on Thursday, and when we went to the dealership to get the car, I went through the car. The highway patrolman told us that there was the only thing in the car was that he went through the trunk and the glove compartment and everything. And the only thing that he found in the car was one of these small notebooks. And it was the last notebook that he's carried, you know. And that was all he saw. So I'm sitting in the car that morning, and I'm going through the glove compartment. And lo and behold, there's his cell phone and the charger cord. The phone was dead. There was no data left on it. Detective Perry told us that that phone had had a hard reset at 3 p.m. on Sunday, the 28th of February.
James's friend Doug didn't know James was missing until he got a call from Ken, completely out of the blue, since he hadn't connected with James in several years. He told us about the call he received from James's dad.
I mean, to be honest, I just talked to him on the phone that one time, and then we just swapped a couple of emails, his dad and I. He called me. And the weird thing is, when it popped up, the number was not saved in my phone because I lost a ton of my contacts a couple of years ago when I left my company. They were all tied to their servers. But when the number came up, I said, "That's James." So it was his dad. And I was like, "Well, this is very odd." And his dad seemed, you know, genuinely distressed about it. The only reference I even knew of his dad was the fact that James, when I was friends with him, never talked to him, ever. So, yeah, it was definitely a very odd thing. To be honest, that was news to me. And I reached out to some old contacts, you know, that were kind of in Dallas, and it was news to them, too.
There was one aspect of James's disappearance that we found particularly unique and intriguing. His parents told us that they had obtained a power of attorney in order to sell a house that James owned in Little Rock. He had never gotten around to selling the house before he moved to Dallas. So his parents stepped in to help. Here's Connie.
He actually held on to that house, and he was in Dallas. Like I say, he started the job in 2010, and I think it was 2013 or 2014 that I went to Little Rock after I retired. I told him I'd go sell the house. He just didn't want to go deal with it. And so he didn't. He just continued to make house payments and apartment payments, and he was okay with that. And I finally convinced him that I would go out after I retired and sell that house. And I did that, which is how we came to have the power of attorney for him, which has been real helpful since he's not around, because we couldn't, you know, I mean, like turning off automatic payments in his bank things, the cable bill and Netflix and that sort of thing. If I didn't have that power of attorney, I wouldn't be able to do any of that stuff. That turned out to be a really lucky thing that worked out for us. And we sold that. So he had whatever the proceeds from that sale were.
James's Aunt Terry told us that she found it strange that James opted to have his mom sell the house instead of taking care of it himself. And she's not sure what the reason was that he made that decision.
He didn't sell it. He might have tried to sell it before he moved, or he might have had to move too quick. But I know that that kind of drug out for a couple of years. He couldn't lease it because it was on a VA note, and they have some kind of thing where you can't do that. And so I know that ultimately his mother kind of went out there and sold that house for him. I said, well, just put it with a real estate agent, and they'll call you and they get it sold. I mean, I don't know if it was just laziness, lack of interest, or it seemed crazy to me at the time to make the mortgage payment and sit on it. But then when Connie retired, you know, it had seemed crazy to them that he was doing that too. And I guess she offered to go out there and have whatever work it was, you know, they felt like the house needed done on. And then she went out there and did that and sold it. I don't know. I don't know if it was laziness. I don't know if it was too busy at work. I don't know if it was lack of motivation. I don't know. I don't know the answer. To me, it seemed like a pretty silly thing to do, but I just figured he had enough money that it didn't matter to him. You know, I couldn't have paid apartment rent and a mortgage on my salary when I was that age, probably. So it seemed weird to me, but I guess it was okay with him.
James's dad, Ken, told us about what he and Connie were able to obtain using the power of attorney that James had signed to sell the house in Little Rock.
We're in the process of trying to get some bank records because of that property sale. There was a power of attorney that he signed in favor of Connie. It was pretty much a blanket power of attorney. It pretty much lists everything, which was kind of handy. It was drawn up by my ex-brother-in-law, who's an attorney, and it was just kind of a standard form, and I think they wanted to be broad rather than narrow, just to make sure that it got its purpose done. And it was never revoked or anything. I mean, he never had a reason to. And we've been trying to use that to get some more information. And we're trying to get bank records. So far, we've gotten since the last year and a half. And he had quite a bit of money in his account, but there wasn't any other deposits. He'd spent it down, basically. I related that to the detective. I didn't send her we've been trying to get more complete records, and I never sent those to her, but I mean, other than the fact that, you know, it kind of indicates to them that he was planning something, or something was happening purposeful, I guess. I don't know what you call it. We found out there was a couple of checks in his apartment that had arrived late that were never, I mean, I think they were like a payoff, he paid off a car loan and there was some remaining balance and they sent him a check and they never did anything with it. It's kind of odd because he always seemed to be busy. He always had projects going on, but then, you know, we come to find out that the everyday things he just didn't seem to pay attention to.
From James's bank records, they could see that James paid his rent monthly, but everything else was paid via scheduled automatic payments. They also noticed something rather strange. There was no income being deposited into his bank account for quite some time. We will delve into this further in a bit. One thing that we found surprising was the different recollections of James that we were hearing from those we spoke to. On one hand, James was willing to sign a blanket power of attorney for his family to sell his home, while on the other hand, others were under the impression that James was estranged from his family.
After I'd known James for a little while, you know, one thing became apparent that I didn't really know anything about his background prior to him, you know, being in Little Rock on our technical team. Pretty quickly, I picked up on there, you know, maybe being a little more of a curtain between him and his past, and that that, you know, he certainly had a family, but I don't think that the lines of communication were probably as open as they could have been. I mean, James is he's a black and white processor, kind of a binary input and output sort of guy, and so I think it's kind of like, you know, he's either communicating with his family or he's not, and for a long time he was not. I picked up on the fact that he felt particularly estranged from his dad. I had never met his dad up until August, when his dad found me by looking through his phone contacts that he had, you know, recently secured. I just, in a million years, cannot imagine how it got there, because I felt the passion and the love and the, you know, distress that his dad was expressing to me immediately. And, you know, as a father, I just can't, I can't even get my head around how it got there or what he must have been feeling. So James is a really strong personality. I won't say he had a problem with authority, but he didn't always see eye to eye with you know, people who were highly authoritative acting, normally because he was smarter than they were. And he kind of wore that sometimes. So I could see where maybe, you know, there could be dust ups if personalities were conflicting. I mean, I am almost certain that he had a brother that with whom he was very estranged from, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I think there was like arguably like really bad blood there, I thought. At least from what I gathered from James around, you know, him not talking to his family, is there was a lot of resentment there. I can't imagine any sort of reality where James would have said, "Hey, parents who I'm wildly estranged from, here's a power of attorney."
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop, with a range of high-quality items priced within reach. Like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices in premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. There was something else that bothered us about the details of James's disappearance, too. And that was the fact that there was no indication that he had worked in several years. After a long, seemingly successful career working for telecommunications companies. Here's Ken again.
He ended up being transferred to Dallas. We found out about that. He had come home. I was actually having some surgery, and he came home to visit, and we found out that he was going to Dallas, and I think Connie told you she has a lot of family around Dallas. He was a little reluctant to get in touch with the family, but he did at some point, then seemed to have a lot of, you know, he had a lot of interaction with them. Connie's sister has four kids. They all live in the Dallas area, and he went to concerts and went out to eat and so forth. There's one of the cousins that is also single, and for a while they were getting together quite a bit. And I think he may have moved away. He was in the Dallas area for a while, and he and Foster did a lot together. And he and his aunt did things together. They seemed to be doing pretty well. You know, this has come as somewhat of a shock, but I don't know precisely where he was working. As far as we knew, he was still working for Verizon. They have an office in Southlake, and that's where he went to work. And the times we went to see him, that's where he was working. From what we've been able to gather from various sources, he hasn't worked there since probably 2017. So I don't really know whether he was working, you know, off the books, you know, working for cash, doing something or what, but he wasn't working there, and I don't know where he was working.
But while there's no indication that he was employed, his Aunt Terry told us that whenever she saw or spoke to James, he talked about work as though everything was normal. So she was surprised to find a box from Verizon in his apartment with what seemed to be all of his belongings from work, and the box had been mailed in 2017.
Several months ago or a couple of months ago when we were over there, looking for stuff, that I noticed that box and noticed that. And the obvious conclusion was, hey, something happened back then. But up until, you know, the last text messages I had from him all through the pandemic, are you working from home? You know, yeah, we always had the capability to work from home and we're just working from home. Are you going back to work? Any talk of going back to the office? No, they haven't talked about it yet. I had no clue. And I have no idea why he wouldn't have told me. Well, he always led us to believe that work was normal. It was the same. He didn't really like his job, but it was well paid, and he didn't seem to be looking for another job. A couple of times I did encourage him to go do that. You know, if you really don't like it, go do something else. I think he was comfortable there. I mean, I can show you text messages and phone conversations that we had, because that is when we bought the house. And when he started coming out here and spending the night, you know, and he would say, oh, I have a 3-day weekend, or I can take off work Friday, or yeah, I have vacation time. I had no idea he was not working. You know, in his apartment, there was a box. And when I opened the box and looked through the box, it was his office desk stuff with an inventory in it. And it was sent to him from Verizon on sometime in April of 2017. And I guess that Connie and Ken have verified that. I don't know if it's through Verizon or if it's through his bank records, you know, that's when the income stopped. I don't know if they actually talked to Verizon or not, but I know that they have verified it from his bank records.
You may be wondering how James was supporting himself from 2017 to 2021, when he ultimately disappeared. According to his parents, he started out with a substantial amount of money between the proceeds from the sale of the Little Rock house, and it appears that he received several lump sum payments over a period of months. Ken and Connie believe that these lump sum payments are some sort of retirement plan buyout. However, by early 2021, it appears that James was beginning to run out of money. Ken later told us via email about the family's search of James's apartment. He said that it didn't appear that James was planning to leave, and that nothing stood out to him immediately. There was leftover pizza in the refrigerator, dishes in the drainer, and dirty clothes in the hamper. They didn't find any bags packed for travel, or an absence of a large amount of clothing, though we aren't sure that James's parents or anyone knew the scope of his belongings in great detail. Ken did say that he was surprised to find that belongings from more than 10 years prior, when James moved from Phoenix to Little Rock, were still packed. Some items which were in perfectly good condition, like a blender, had been packed in a box and a new one purchased instead. Checks were left uncashed for months, and there was a TV on James's bed, though Ken said that James sometimes struggled with sleeping and may have preferred the couch. They found a laptop that didn't prove to be useful. It seemed old, and they believe that he must have had a much newer one. But if he did have a newer laptop, that's never been located. Doug told us that James was always very routined and structured as a person, but that maybe the isolation of being stuck at home during the pandemic affected James more than anyone knew, and that possibly some of his more ritualistic tendencies turned into obsessive behavior.
He was in the Marine Corps drill team, the silent drill team, which I challenge you to YouTube the Marine Corps silent drill team. These guys do like the kind of the ornate sort of drills, like where they, you know, they're spinning their guns and they're firing shots and they're doing formations. And you think, like, in my opinion, you have to be a very obsessive person to perfect that type of art. To me, that is a real insight into who James was in his personality. James would obsess with things. You know, it was kind of endearing and funny and hilarious when he would get obsessed about something that he was making fun of, right? But kind of hindsight being 2020 and me being a lot older and more mature now, it was not normal. And I don't mean to say not normal as in, like, I didn't think James was normal. He was a really great friend of mine. But if you ever went to James's house, it was always super clean, like obsessively clean. I think he had a really hard time through COVID, is what his dad told me. But I can see where, you know, if James became, you know, kind of overwhelmingly obsessed with cleanliness and staying away from people and kind of obsessing about that with all of the free time in the world, then I could see where it could potentially become a problem. If over the years of being kept down at work and then eventually terminated against his will, and then, you know, being sort of feeling victimized by COVID and what that meant. And, you know, you kick enough of those really highly obsessive processes into the mix with a good batch of, you know, depression. You know, it's not a huge stretch to hear, to think about something else happening. But the thing about James is, like, I think he would have created something else for himself. I mean, unless he was just so mentally broken or that he just didn't feel like there was any other direction to go. Wildly successful people and wildly driven people are sometimes really close to the edge of, you know, graying into mental illness. And to me, that makes a lot more sense here than, you know, some kind of dark, nefarious activities. And I don't want to say that suicide makes sense. It's so odd. I mean, I can't make heads or tails of any of it. But, I mean, I would even think if James was going to kill himself, he would have at least left a note.
Terry said that the pandemic definitely left its mark on James, and that he changed his habits very rigidly. First, we asked her to tell us how frequently she had been seeing or hearing from James prior to the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Once or twice a month, we'd go to dinner, we'd go to a show, so we would go do stuff. But once we moved out here, our house has a little guest house to it. It's not really a house. It's just a bedroom and a bathroom, you know, and a little sitting area. But Foster would come out here and spend the weekends with us. or come out here and spend, you know, a couple of days during the week. He's always been like super private. He would come out, and I would say he came out at least every couple of months, and sometimes during the summer, every month. You know, he would come out for holidays, for Thanksgivings, and not so much Christmas, but he would come for 4th of July, and he would come for Thanksgiving, you know, and all my kids would be here. And he's real close, or he was real close at one time with one of my boys.
Terry explained how things changed in early 2020 after the beginning of the pandemic.
I think he took the pandemic way more seriously than any 48-year-old that was in good health I knew of. Most of my kids were all, well, they were all kind of like in mandatory keep working jobs, you know, and so they just had to shrug it off and keep going. Foster was really paranoid about the pandemic, and he was very concerned about us contracting COVID. You know, he would send very detailed advice about going to the grocery stores and wearing masks and don't do this and don't get out. And he would say that he's not getting out or doing anything but going to the grocery store. And, you know, I'd be like, well, Foster, you got to see some people. You got to talk to some people, you know, come out and spend the weekend with us. We haven't been around anybody. The kids haven't been here. We haven't seen anybody for 2 weeks. And he wouldn't budge.
While we were researching this story, it seemed like no one really knew what was going on in James's life leading up to his disappearance. He wasn't in frequent contact with family members. While he had seen his aunt and some cousins more often prior to the pandemic, this stopped. But even before this, no one seemed to realize that James wasn't working any longer, for what appears to be a period of years. He had made comments to family members that implied that he was still working, but his family has found no records of any income in the past several years. We worked to try to find people who knew James around this time or had contact with him, even if it was just over the phone or on social media, and we simply couldn't find anyone. We know that when he lived in Arkansas, he had friendships there that he maintained and spent time with his friends and coworkers doing various activities outside of work. Terry told us that James seemed to become very isolated after his move to Grapevine, and sometimes even made jokes about it.
Once he moved to Grapevine, his standard line was that he didn't have any friends. You know, he said that's why he had a great big moving dolly and a truck. You know, I used to tease him about keeping two vehicles, and he said, when you don't have any friends, you have to have a truck because you don't have anybody to borrow one from. I do not think he was especially close to anybody. And if he was, it was not something he shared. And like I said, to the contrary, he would make jokes about not especially liking people. Aunt Terry, you're the only person that I really like. And I just kind of put up with all those other people because of you. I never heard him talk about socializing with anybody in Grapevine. And I think a lot of times he would back it up by saying, But I understand because I'm perfectly antisocial and I don't really like people anyway. You know, he would make those kind of jokes.
Did James have a group of friends in the Grapevine area that he simply never talked about with family? What was he doing with all of his time if he wasn't working? These questions were nagging at us and his family too. Could he have been working somewhere under the table? If he was, he wasn't depositing anything into his bank account. Was there something that James wanted to keep a secret? If so, why? James's family has been digging through the records that they've been able to get their hands on, and they have access to some of his cell phone records dating back to early 2020. They can see his outgoing calls, and they said that he was making two or fewer calls most months. His parents traced the calls that James made in 2020, and they were mostly to his landlord, a pizza shop, and a tire dealer. Nothing to indicate that he was communicating with someone like a friend or significant other on a regular basis. Is it possible that James could have had another phone, or perhaps was using some kind of app to communicate with people? James's family has learned that in February of 2021, just shortly before James disappeared, he had made several calls to various Motel 6 locations. Why was James calling these motels, and why did he go stay at one? We don't know the answer to these questions, but we feel like maybe this could be an important clue. Maybe there was something going on that's yet to be uncovered. As Ken mentioned earlier, they had initially thought that James had possibly lost power during the winter storm and was looking for a warm place to stay. But they learned that his apartment complex never lost power, so there must have been some other reason for him to stay at the motel. Beyond James's phone calls, they can see that there were text messages, but they can't see who they were sent to or the content of those messages. Still, James's text messages were few and far between. James had 19 text messages in January and 3 in February. While we were working on this story, we couldn't help but feel like James's life was just as much of a mystery as his disappearance. Was James the person who had done the factory reset on his phone on February 28th? Or could it have been someone else? Terry told us why she thinks James may have done this.
I'm not surprised that his phone is wiped, because if he was leaving his phone, which he did, I don't know why he didn't destroy his phone, you know, or take it with him. Or, I mean, I guess he knew people could. He worked at Verizon. I'm pretty sure he knew how to destroy it. So I don't understand why he did that. I think he probably thought that if he just deleted everything, I think that if his mother or his dad picked up his phone, there probably would have been things on it that he wouldn't necessarily have wanted them to see. And I'm just talking about text messages, things that he'd said, things that he'd done. And like I said, he was intensely private. So if he voluntarily left, it doesn't surprise me that he wiped his phone.
Connie told us that of all the factors that may have played a role in James's disappearance, there's one thing that she's certain of, and that's that James was not misusing substances or alcohol.
I have a family history of self-medicating drunks. His brother has bipolar, among maybe some other things that are sprinkled in there. And his brother refuses to take medication. I have bipolar, and there's not a day goes by that I don't take my medication, because I don't like feeling the way I do if I don't. But Foster has never exhibited any of that, so far as, you know, mood swings or anything like that. He drinks, you know, but I don't think it's to excess. I mean, a lot of it is social. He loves to play around with, you know, like making the best margarita. And good heavens, he will go buy $200 worth of ingredients to come home and make 3 batches of margaritas for a group of people. His fascination is in doing it the best way, finding the best possible. Not a substance abuse, no.
We asked everyone we talked to what they think happened to James. And with so many unknowns, the possibilities are nearly endless. Doug told us this about James.
Thinking about James, but I've got to kind of keep reminding myself, I knew James really well in a completely different time in life. But I just think how many things would have to go wrong. I mean, like, I went through a period, you know, lost a job and had a really hard time kind of getting back to, you know, I started a business, and that was a very hard thing that took way longer than I anticipated. But it's like, sometimes, I mean, to some people that program just kind of runs all the time. Like, you know, the suicide is always an option, but like, in my head, it never is, has, or probably will be, you know, and I kind of feel like he was probably programmed that way. But also, who would James have mixed it up with that wanted him to disappear? That James was just going to go off grid? That's not a stretch for me to believe at all. Now, what's significantly harder for me to believe is that he would have left every reasonable necessity, phones, car, and just kind of bailed and not let anybody know when, where, and how. I think as a Marine, James would have been more responsible to the mission than that. But James going to live in a hut out in the wilderness or something like that wouldn't come as a massive shock to me, I don't think. I think it's possible, especially depending on what his mental state was around, you know, around COVID and being away from people. He was not a real impulsive kind of person. I mean, he was obsessive, sure, but impulsive, not as much. He was pretty calculated. The whole driving off to Texarkana and ditching the car. And I actually had to drive to Texarkana a few weeks ago, or a couple of weeks ago. And I just stopped through that rest stop and just kind of looked around, and you think like, well, where the hell would you have gone from here? I mean, I intentionally stopped there just because I was curious, you know, about what could have possibly drawn him there. Why was that where the car was, you know? I mean, it doesn't even begin to make any sense why you would have picked there. You know, thinking about James potentially getting messed up in anything illegal would be extremely far-fetched, at least during the era that I was really close with him. And that's not to say that things couldn't have changed with him. He didn't particularly assimilate to, like, the darker side of life, I don't think.
James's dad, Ken, also gave us his perspective on what may have happened.
Of course, this goes around your mind day in and day out. I don't know. Personally, he paid his rent 2 months in advance. He has everything on automatic payment. He had just about run out of money from his bank records. He was down to a couple of $1,000s. And given all of that, I think whatever it was, he planned it. And I don't know. You know, he was not the kind of a person that you would think of that would, you know, go join a cult or something like that. He was actually dismissive of people like that. But it's hard for me to imagine him just wanting to disappear into the wild. And if so, why didn't he have any cash with him? That bothers me. On the other hand, I have a hard time seeing him as a victim of crime. I suppose something's possible, but I don't know, you know, what would have happened. We speculated, you know, if he got out of his car at the welcome center, you know, somebody could have done something. But I mean, he's like 6'1" and you know, fairly stout individual. And I would think he'd be a bad person to pick on if you were trying to commit a crime. But none of us are immune from that. So I don't know. I really think it was planned, but I can't think of what. There's like one cash withdrawal. Now, there was, somebody pointed this out, that, you know, when you buy things, you can get cash back. Like at Walmart, I guess, will give you $100. I don't generally do that. I go to the ATM. But yeah, as far as I know, he didn't have a credit card. It was just this debit card. So he could have been getting cash that way, but it's still not a bunch of cash. And he had, it was like $29,000 in the bank at the end of, what was it, 2019? The bank shows the rent payments are all coming out of that. The insurance payments are all coming out of that. The cars were paid off at that time. There wasn't too much spending. Walmart, grocery store, liquor store. He did like good quality liquor. I think he was drinking scotch at the time. And so somebody pointed out that $70 wouldn't be a lot of money to spend for a good bottle of scotch. So, but that was about it. I mean, there wasn't a lot of other spending, but it was enough to bring that. There was nothing but withdrawals or spending and no income in the account. Now, if he had another account, we don't know about it. If he was accumulating cash at some fashion, I don't know about that either. Once you find out your kid has quit 2 years ago and telling you he's still working and whatnot, it's hard to rule out anything. But he's never, ever shown anything like that or any inclination like that and has always been really brutally honest and gets mad at people who aren't honest. Now, if he was doing some tech support on the side for cash, I don't know. You kind of have to promote stuff like that. And he doesn't seem like he was getting out and doing things. He just was not one to ask for help. I co-signed a loan for him when he was in the Marines to buy a car. And he made all of his payments on time and everything. And that was the last time and I ever provided any financial support. I mean, he was living here for a few months, but you know, other than that, we didn't really have a routine and had actually in the past year or so, we saw him in summer of 2019, I think, and did some texting back and forth, maybe did some calls. And I don't know that there was a routine. And actually, you know, we probably didn't talk to him that much in the last couple of years. So, you know, looking back, you kind of regret stuff like that. But he always seemed to be busy, and we've invited him out a few times, and he's like, no, I don't think so. And so texted back and forth some and talked occasionally, but nothing on a regular basis.
Ken said that he doesn't believe suicide is part of the outcome in James's story because of things that he had said about suicide in the past.
He was kind of a complicated guy, and like I say, he's very clever. We have thought about, you know, maybe he left a clue in one of those books or something, but so far nothing. It wouldn't be unlike him to figure out something, you know, or to plan out something. But on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, of course, we've thought about suicide, but there's no body. And he's always was dead set against. I mean, we've had discussions with his mom about how you hurt, you know, the people around you and so forth, and I would never do that and whatnot. Detectives said, you know, suicides generally don't, you know, worry about what their car looks like or anything like that. They just kind of go do what they go do. Like I say, it was kind of hunkering down. But as far as anybody knew, and when anybody talked to him, it was just like, you know, COVID, I'm not going to go out. I've known some other people that kind of reacted like that. So everybody was always very fond of Foster, and all the cousins have been worried. And he's one of those people that, you know, I have a hard time figuring out. And I mean, he might have done this and he might have done that and he might have connived something. There's so many possibilities that I guess we just kind of keep plodding along and hope something comes up and hope it's good news and not bad.
For James's aunt, Terry, she also looks at James paying 2 months of rent ahead of his disappearance as a sign of something. Exactly what? She isn't sure.
I mean, the paying the rent for 2 months, he was planning on doing something different. But I have no idea what happened. You know, whether he parked his car at that truck stop and got a ride. We've been told from several people that at that, and it's not a truck stop, but that rest stop, and there was a big truck area and trucks stop there. And we've been told, you know, by the highway people in Arkansas and by the maintenance people there, you know, that there were truck drivers that would give you a lift for $30 or just the company. Or there's a big, big part of me that doesn't think that he would just leave without telling me, even if he just told me he was leaving, just going to go do something different for a while and he would get in touch with me. But obviously he has. And I don't know. I'd have had an entirely different life that I didn't know anything about. I was struck when we went through his apartment, his suitcase when he comes out here, his doc kit that he carries when he comes out, you know, just all of that stuff is there. And it's what he always brought out here. It's the shaving kit he always brought out here. It's the clothes that he always brought out here. The boots, the shoes he wore. All of that is at the apartment. Everything I know about him, other than his laptop and his Kindle, are still in that apartment. And it just seems like if you were going to go off and have a different life, you know, if you were going to go to Alaska and work on a boat or go whatever, that he would have sold his assets. He, you know, he had two vehicles that were completely paid for. He had a ton of gaming equipment and musical equipment that was worth money. He was such a private person that it boggles my mind that he would walk out and leave that knowing that somebody was going to have to deal with it, you know, that somebody was going to be going through his stuff.
So what happened to James Foster Chance between his birthday on January 19th and the date that his phone was wiped at the Texarkana Welcome Center on February 28th? Why did he travel through dangerous winter weather to get to a motel when the apartment management told his parents that they never lost power? Why travel to that motel, with hundreds of them nearby in the area surrounding the DFW airport? And what was he doing after he had quit or lost his job? What did he do with all of his time? Was James really a loner? We heard mixed accounts of his personality. Some said he was outgoing and social, and others characterized him as someone who almost had a fear of leaving home. Why did he purposefully, or so it seems, wipe his phone? Was he at that motel the week before planning to disappear? Was this all part of a long-term plan? Or was James, like so many, feeling the effects of a year of COVID with no end in sight and losing hope for his life? If James took his own life, why hasn't he been found? There are so many questions that seem as though the answer is just out of reach. And yet, we couldn't quite grasp them. We're left with more questions than we can even begin to ask. And it seems as though any outcome is a realistic possibility in this case. At the time of his disappearance, James Foster Chance was 48 years old. He was approximately 6 feet tall and weighed around 175 pounds. He has red hair and blue-green eyes. If you have any information about the disappearance of James Foster Chance, you're asked to call the Grapevine Police Department at 817-470-8127.
My impression was, I'm talking with this detective, that They were kind of on shaky ground, they felt, from a standpoint of there's no indication of a crime, but kind of limited what they felt they could do. He's always been pretty upbeat and outgoing. I say outgoing, he's a private person, but if you get him in a group, he tends to be outgoing. He's very smart, kind of intolerant of people who aren't. Like I say, he's not really socially liked eating out, but kind of with a select group of people. I guess that's about how I would describe it. If you met him, especially in a group, you would see him as very friendly and outgoing. Private life was pretty private, so you know, if he had enemies, I don't know that I'd know about it, but it would surprise me. He's kind of a low-key, easygoing guy most of the time, and I don't know I have any notion, nor does anybody that I've talked to have any notion that somebody would want to bring harm to him. It's a total mystery, and I think of different scenarios, but nothing gels.
We were over there last week closing out Foster's apartment, and it was pretty traumatic and hard on them. I don't think he can get into the phone because he doesn't have a password, the code. The police tried. I know that they tried to subpoena the phone records, and evidently either the grand jury or the district attorney wouldn't do that. Even though there's a lot of oddness, there's exigent circumstances, I guess they'd call it, but there's no real signs of foul play yet, and maybe they don't have a right to go into his, I don't know the answer to that. Seems like a real balancing act.
That brings us to the end of episode 318. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be bringing you a case from Michigan. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients, popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.